News. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your community with the world. I'm Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo. Arizona's tough new immigration law has placed immigration reform on the front burner of U.S. politics, and the rhetoric over paperwork, profiling, and penalties could hardly be hotter. The push for reform has ebbed and flowed along with our economy. Most of the talk focuses on enforcement. Who gets to stay in this country? How many? And for how long? But for those who cross borders looking for a better life, the most important question is, why leave home at all? The answer to that question is the key to effective immigration reform, says Jeffrey Kay, a veteran journalist who's traveled the world reporting on mass migration. In his new book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration, Jeffrey Kay explores the economic, political, and social factors that push people to move away from home. Well, Jeffrey Kay, this last few days and weeks with the change in the law in Arizona is forcing yet another debate in this country about immigration. And there was an interesting poll in yesterday's New York Times about what Americans think of this new law, which gives police power to question anyone they suspect might be in the country illegally. And interestingly, a slight majority, 51% of those polled said that they thought that the law is just about right, and only 36% said it goes too far. And yet, when you ask people whether the federal government or states should be making laws to handle immigration, people overwhelmingly say this is a federal issue. So there does seem to be a kind of contradiction within the views that Americans hold about this.
There are a lot of confusion. There's a lot of confusion about immigration and who's responsible and what enforcement is going to do. Going back to that poll, when people were asked about whether they think the law will be effective, I don't have it in front of me, but not everyone thought, or less than half, I believe, thought that it would actually reduce immigration. So people are confused, and when times get tough, as they are now, historically, people tend to take it out on migrants. That's when the greatest numbers of people have been deported from this country.
Is it as simple as that? Is the agitation over illegal immigration purely a reflection of tough economic times and competition for jobs, or are there deeper issues there?
Well, I think there are many issues. I think that when times get tough, that's the thing that comes to the surface. Obviously, there are racial issues. There's anxiety about people who don't look like us or speak the same language as we do. And again, you know, these debates get recycled from decade to decade, century to century. Benjamin Franklin worried that too many migrants from Germany were pouring into Pennsylvania, worried aloud that he said at one point we might have to have interpreters who will interpret what half the legislature is saying so that the other half can understand. So these are deep-seated, anxious moments that we go through from time to time. And what I'm trying to do is to help recast and rethink the debate, to look at the reasons that people migrate. Because it's my belief that, frankly, Arizona can't go it alone, and nor can the United States deal with it on a national basis. It's an international issue, and that's where we need to be heading.
And we'll talk about global migration and the forces that promote it in a few moments. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet to @KojoShow. We are joined in studio by Jeffrey Kay, and on the phone from New York, NPR studios there, Manuel Orozco is Director of Remittances and Development at the Inter-American Dialogue. And Manuel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What, Manuel, because the trickle-down effect from the downturn in the U.S. economy is so severe on other countries, do we see movement from foreign countries to try to support their migrants? In other words, are they playing a role, or should they be playing a greater role in taking care of the people who are leaving their countries?
Well, from the policy standpoint, they should be playing a role. Whether they do or not, it's a different reality. In practical terms, they're not playing a role, not because they don't want to, but largely because they don't know how to deal with this issue, how to leverage, for example, the resources, the foreign savings that come from migrants into their home countries, how to deal with a potential return of migrants in case of a continued effect of the recession, etc. So the governments are basically facing this reality of international migration in a larger scale than ever before. And they have really difficulty on how to tackle the problem. And I think there is no doubt that there is an element of class component to this, and opportunism, that some governments or the leaders or the elites of these countries don't really care if people leave. Once they leave, they have a partial solution to these economic challenges that they have in their own countries.
And Jeffrey Kay, in your book, Moving Millions, you kind of steer away from this whole argument over how to control immigrants or how to manage the movement of people and look at the context of why people migrate. Is that something that changes over time, or are there enduring forces that are always at the heart of why people are moving?
Well, I think there are enduring forces. Obviously, circumstances change as globalization changes, as the nature of globalization changes and transportation systems change and enforcement efforts change. But I think at the heart of it, at the root of it, we're hardwired to go someplace where we think we might be able to improve our lives. We've been doing that ever since humans left East Africa. On the route to something better. And it's a personal calculation. If the risk is worth the potential opportunity, people are going to make that move. But it's also, it goes beyond the personal to the larger issues that push people out and pull people in.
And when you look at that from the American perspective, given our history and the great American myth of migration and our creativity always being fueled and revived by new waves of immigration, is that American dream still, I mean, obviously it speaks to people overseas, but is it as widely accepted in our country as it once was?
I think that's situational. If you're asking whether we are we accepting today of migrants, no, we're clearly not. But that changes, and when the economic need is there, time and again, we've either recruited migrants or worked hard in some way to open the door wider. When the economy goes bad, we closed the door. During World War I, World War II, there were active efforts to bring in migrants from Mexico. After those wars, when the economy went bad, there were active efforts to deport those people. Going back even further, we welcomed Chinese laborers until the economy had problems in the 1870s, and the first restrictive law against an ethnic group, Chinese, was passed in 1882, and we did what we could to prevent more Chinese from coming in.
And has that kind of policy setting always happened at the federal level, or are the kinds of local and state level initiatives that we've seen here in Prince William County in Virginia, and now in Arizona, is that something new?
Well, before there was a constitution, I believe, or right around the founding of the country, I haven't got my dates in front of me, policies were controlled at the state and local levels until it was determined that immigration should be a federal policy. But in recent years, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of bills and resolutions passed around the country, either at the state level or at the municipal level, to try to regulate migration because it was felt that Washington wasn't doing its job.
And that frustration over the lack of federal reform is something we've heard about from politicians for years and from grassroots groups across the country. Why is the this may be an impossible question to answer, but why is the federal government unwilling or incapable of coming up with a reform package that would make it not necessary for all of these localities to feel they have to create their own rules?
Well, because as immigration reform has moved forward, those people who are involved in and have the desire for comprehensive immigration reform, as they put it, are trying to package deals. And the packages have always included the opportunity to bring in more workers, as well, and enforce more laws or beef up the border enforcement or interior enforcement, and at the same time provide a path to legalization or amnesty, however you want to couch it. And that's a very problematic political proposition, to legalize as many as 11, 12 million people. That's the difficulty. Go ahead.
If I may add,
please.
I think to add on to what Jeff says, one of the main problems, why is it that states have been pursuing policies in the last 5-6 years, is also related to the fact that this is the first time where we don't have an immigration reform in over 20 years. We have had in 86, in 1965, 1952, and you can go back and there is a reform within a 15-year period, more or less, but this time it's much longer. What happens over that time period is that you have basically the effect of a moral hazard that reduces the risk among politicians, the risk acceptance to take on the challenge to do something about it. And you get confused, perhaps, or unable to take on a stand, especially at the moment where the whole security industrial complex comes around in the 21st century. And that's where basically migration turns into a security issue rather than an issue that has more complexities.
It does seem that prior to 9/11, the Bush administration was moving toward immigration reform. There was something of an emerging consensus that at least something had to be done, and there was an incentive for the Republicans to get serious about this because they were felt that they were in danger of being tarred as an anti-Hispanic party, and yet 9/11 seems to have brought all of that to a halt.
More important than that, I think, is the fact that negotiations and discussions had been opened up between the United States and Mexico, both at the foreign ministry level and at the presidential level. Just a few days before 9/11, President Vicente Fox came to visit George Bush, and one of the issues on the plate was immigration. After 9/11, that issue evaporated, and unfortunately, security issues became conflated with immigration. I think they're separate and need to be dealt with in separate ways, but there's no question that those two things got muddled, as crime has also got muddled. People look at crime on the Arizona and at the southern border and talk about the drug cartels with obvious and reasonable cause for alarm. But again, crime, terrorism, those are unrelated to immigration. In the 1950s, there were headlines about the Reds coming over the border from Mexico. So we tend to confuse a lot of these issues without really focusing on some of the real ones.
Kathleen in Washington, D.C., it's your turn.
Hi there, and please give me an opportunity to make a cogent statement. I'll tell you what has not been muddled. I used to live in Douglas, Arizona, in the 60s, early 60s. And Douglas, Arizona is right on the border with Agua Prieta. And most of the Mexicanos knew clearly the only thing that was separating the United States from Mexico was the Ocotillo cactus. What happened that no one has really dealt with is that in the 70s, the decision on a public policy basis was made to create and make African-American men economic Dalits, in other words, untouchables and mass incarceration. And that opened the door and a welcome mat for labor that would have been taken care of with African-American men. That meant that you opened the door for illegal alien labor because you kept the prices down.
Well, that's an interesting conspiracy theory, Jeffrey Kay. anything to it?
Well, I'm not sure about that. Labor had been, and Mexicans had been coming across the border since the early 1900s when the railways were linked up between the United States and Mexico. Laborers were needed in the United States. The economy was bad in Mexico, and the political situation was difficult. There was a tradition of migration that was established a long, long time ago. I would actually look and trace back what's been going on recently in Arizona to the Bill Clinton administration. What the Clinton administration did in the early 1990s in reaction to quite a number of migrants coming across, and in reaction also to the political consternation in both California and Texas and elsewhere, was he militarized the border in both California and Texas with the intent of trying to drive migrants through Arizona, have them possibly be deterred by the inhospitable terrain, by the desert. The problem, of course, was that the deterrence didn't really work, since nothing changed economically. The push conditions, people coming from Mexico, had actually been exacerbated by economic crises in Mexico. And as the economy changed, particularly in California, towards a service economy, the demand for migrant labor was there, and so people kept coming. So that's where I would look at. So there was a collision course that was almost inevitable as people kept coming into one of the most conservative states in the Union.
Are you from a family of immigrants? What drove you to leave your homeland? Or do you think Americans are more welcoming to upper-tier white-collar immigrants than to blue-collar ones? We'll talk about class and immigration and take more of your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Coming up after a short break. You're listening to The Kodjoe Namdi Show.
Congratulations to the staff of The Kodjoe Namdi Show for winning the 2009 James Beard Award for Best Radio Show or Audio Broadcast. Time Magazine calls the James Beard Awards the Oscars of the food world. They celebrate and nurture America's culinary heritage and diversity. The award recognizes how Kodjoe and his staff use our local food scene to examine how our community interacts and connects.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Folger Theater, where Hamlet is now on stage along with Hamfest, a series of events inspired by Shakespeare's tale of murder and revenge. Tickets at folger.edu or 202-544-7077. From Calypso Organic Selections, working with earth-supporting producers worldwide to bring you organic wine, beer, and spirits. More at calypso-organics.com.
We're in a new member campaign during Morning Edition this week. Your support truly makes a difference. Become a member or rejoin now at 800-248-8850 or online at WAMU.org and enter a drawing to win an Apple iPad. Thanks. Sunny and warm this afternoon. Temperatures in the low 80s by the end of the day with south winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour, 79 degrees. In Northwest Washington, as we return to the Kodjoe Namdi Show.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, sitting in on the Kodjoe Namdi Show. We're talking with Jeffrey Kay, the author of Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration, and Manuel Orozco, the Director of Remittances and Development at the Inter-American Dialogue. And Manuel, the new Arizona law has fueled this common perception that the U.S. is being overwhelmed by low-wage foreign workers. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of jobs immigrants to the United States really do take?
Well, the classification is extremely large. I mean, if you work in terms of classifying in terms of skilled, unskilled, and semi-skilled labor, you have a significant distribution. 40% of immigrant labor is actually skilled labor, and within that you have a percent of people, over 20%, who have a professional education. Then you have the semi-skilled labor, who are people who work, for example, in construction and learn the trade. And then you have the less skilled labor, people who work in some of aspects of the service industry, whether working in restaurants or in the hospitality industry at large. Those are the ones that you can think of as the low-wage earners, who compensate basically with the low wages by working 18, 20 hours a day sometimes.
And Jeffrey Kay, this image of American jobs being taken by low-earning foreign immigrants, how does that comport with the reality in terms of how we really use immigrant labor in this country?
Well, whether or not jobs are being taken, the question almost implies that Americans somehow once used to do these jobs and then they were taken over by foreigners. I don't think that's the case. If some of the job categories that Manuel mentioned have been done historically by migrant workers, and obviously employers are going to go to hire those people who they can for the cheapest wages. And that's just a fact of life. And one of the things that I think that when we look at some of the factors driving migration, it's been a consistent objective of employers to bring in as many migrants as they possibly can, whether that's high-skilled workers or low-skilled workers. Today, as the economy is...
Is that because of a dissatisfaction with the American worker, or is it simply looking for the cheapest possible labor?
More workers you got, the lower wages you can pay. They're not going to say that. That's what my belief is, that the lobby for the computer industry will tell the lobbyists from the computer industry will say we need to import as many workers as possible because they're innovative and they bring much needed skills that we don't have. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But at both ends of the spectrum, clearly, as I said before, the more workers you have, the less pressure there is on wages. And so some of the people who are doing the active campaigning, even in this economy, to bring in more workers are those attached to the Chamber of Commerce on the one hand, high-tech industry on the other, and of course the farmers and growers who want to bring in workers under temporary worker programs. The pressure is always there.
Nick in Winchester, it's your turn.
Nick?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. Hi, Mark. I'll try to be succinct, but I've got to make about 3 or 4 points.
Let's start with one.
Okay, I'll try one. All right. First is that immigration law, ever since 1965, and everything, all the programs under that, have resulted in a shift of immigration from Western Europe to Latin America, south of the border, South Asia and East Asia and the Pacific. That's the first thing. And I think in terms of fairness, when we're talking about legalization and an opportunity to advance towards citizenship for people who are here illegally, we ought to think about it, all the people that are listed under priority immigration who can't get here for years. Their priority dates are somewhere like in many cases 10 or 15 years ago, and the priority dates move forward maybe 1 week a month if they're lucky. Now, like I said, fairness to people who are here illegally, fair to people that are waiting. But I think you have to acknowledge the injustice to the people that are waiting legally. Okay.
Manuel Orozco, maybe you can respond to Nick here. I mean, there is, in this sense of the backlog of legal immigrants to our country, it's kind of often put forward as evidence that the system is broken.
I think Nick is totally right. One of the reasons why you probably have the undocumented flow is because the waiting list is too long. There are families that are waiting to reunite legally for 10, 15 years because the system just cannot deal with the processing of the applications. Why can't they deal? You can invite a bureaucrat to tell you the different reasons they may have. But I think, you know, the fairness aspect is very valid. It's something that has to be included in any debate on immigration reform, but it's also directly connected to the legalization of people who are already here without papers. And the other point that he make, I think, is very important, you know, this shifting immigration to more or less to developing countries. But it's not just economics, it's politics too. If you look at the countries from which migrants are coming from, they're not coming from countries where there is a strong demand for foreign labor because of their skills, but there is an association to political issues, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, Vietnamese. You keep running through the list, and there is an issue of foreign policy, the effect of foreign policy and the national security interest that has on people migrating here is something that is completely neglected. And you cannot just talk on one time about the illegals and on the other hand just ignore the realities of the United States in the foreign policy environment.
Jeffrey Kay, there's an interesting email from Keith in Silver Spring asking, why do we always discuss legal and illegal immigration in the same breath? They're two completely different issues, he says, and he wishes people would treat them as such.
They're not completely different issues. People migrate for the same reasons, whether they're legal or illegal. And the laws change over the time. You know, a lot of people like to romanticize the past and talk about my grandparents did it legally. Well, the laws were different. And if we're going to really have a serious conversation about migration, then we need to kind of look beyond the legal issues. With a stroke of the pen, Ronald Reagan legalized 3 million people who were here illegally. What was different between those people today and those people then and 11, 12 illegal immigrants today? Not a whole lot. So the law doesn't get you very far in dealing with basic issues about why people migrate.
So there has been a political shift, even as we've left the laws the way they were. You talk in your book about these iconic conservatives, Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, who you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. These were people, Republican leaders, who probably would not be very comfortable with the Republican Party's dominant position on illegal immigration today.
Conservatives call Ronald Reagan's amnesty, granting amnesty, Reagan's big mistake. And that's one place they take a big issue with what Ronald Reagan did. Barry Goldwater was pretty much of a laissez-faire capitalist. His family actually employed illegal migrants. Goldwater, I'm not sure where he would be today. He definitely supported temporary worker programs, and he also said that it was the responsibility of the federal government, not the state, to take care of the issue.
So how do you explain the shift in Republican ideology on this issue?
Well, I'm not sure there's been a complete shift in ideology. I think the states are taking matters into their own hands because, as we said before, there's this growing frustration about what to do and a growing anger and anxiety as the state has changed. Arizona's gone through a remarkable demographic shift in a very short period of time. And those kinds of changes, as I experienced in California growing up and as a reporter, can be very disquieting for people. When you see billboards going up and menus changing and people speaking languages that you don't understand, that can be very uncomfortable for people, as it has been over the decades.
Manuel, as you look at the Arizona law, and what effect do you think it will have on the push for immigration reform in Congress this year and in the future?
I don't know. Honestly, I think you can speculate in the two possible directions. One is the potential impact of galvanizing a debate that goes beyond the rhetoric but actually turns into a very well-negotiated immigration bill that is actually at the best time in its momentum to be reviewed. I mean, we have deported over 3 million people since 2002. The decline on immigration has also provided the conditions to really deal with the people who are already here, including those who are waiting. But you also can have the other side of the equation, or both at the same time, which is that together to this galvanized social movement to have an immigration reform, you're going to see more radicalism of supporting this type of Arizona type of exercises. The reason being that immigration is perhaps one of the most contentious political issues in U.S. politics. It's the one that cut across divides of ideology and other types of beliefs. Therefore, you always see poll after poll that people are basically divided 50-50 over these issues. So you may have an increased polarization over this, and one has to take the first step to provide a solution, at least in the short term, to begin moving into a regularized process in the longer term.
Jeffrey Kay?
Yeah, I agree with everything Manuel just said. I think a couple of things have happened. It certainly has moved immigration and the immigration debate to the front burner, although these things do go in cycles. It's also racialized, I think, to a large extent, the debate over immigration as people try to figure out how Arizonans might enforce a law, even though the defenders say there's no way, it's not a racial issue. I can't see the sheriff of Maricopa County going after Canadians here on expired visas. I think that it has galvanized both sides of the political debate, those who see an injustice has been done, or feel an injustice has been done, and those who want more Arizona-type laws. But as to your question about where things might head with comprehensive immigration reform, we're heading into election year, and I think many people can put a wet finger in the wind and figure that this might not be the best time to pass a law that might grant some kind of legalization to 11 or 12 million people.
So a little more stalemate before anything moves.
I think so.
Let's bring into the conversation Emily Levitt. She's a professor at the School of International Service at American University, and she has students who are looking at migration to the Washington, D.C. area from Mexico, El Salvador, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. What have your students been doing, and what have they found?
Thank you very much for this opportunity. The students at the end of the semester opted, and I thought quite wisely, to do this class project instead of take a 2.5-hour written exam. And what their project involved was interviewing different immigrants to the D.C. area, listening to their story, and trying to research what were the reasons, the drivers, as you've been describing it, the drivers of migration to cause people to leave and want to make a home in a new country. And as they learned these different issues, they then also had to go to the library and to research and to understand not only from a handful of immigrant stories, but also what is the research and the literature saying about these issues, and then they had to put a report together. And what I find really interesting, particularly in contrast with what we've been hearing out of Arizona and whatnot, is instead of focusing on the barriers, we were looking at what needs to be done to address the causes. And so the students were looking at, for example, in the case of Ethiopia, there's a lot of challenges with land reform. And the government has taken over control of quite a lot of the land, and the people don't feel ownership over the land. And so there's not a lot of incentive to invest in local agriculture because of insecurity over land titling. So there were issues like that the students were identifying, that if we were to look at trying to address immigration issues, perhaps governments could partner to look at what are the actual reasons why people are feeling so desperate and needing to leave.
Great. Jeffrey Kay?
Yeah, I think that adds an important component to the debate and the discussion. I don't want to tread on Manuel's territory. He knows far more about remittances than I do. That's the money sent back. But it amounts to more than $300 billion a year, which is an amazing amount of money that's going through global systems from migrants who leave their countries back home. And a lot of those remittances have been channeled into economic development. That will obviously have a great deal of benefit. Much of the remittances are used for personal reasons, but where they have been channeled in the few places they have been for economic development, those obviously have helped build an economic infrastructure that has probably done more to deter migration, at least in small communities and small areas, than any number of fences and border guards ever will.
Thanks very much, Emily. When we come back after a short break, we will join Jeffrey Kay and Manuel Orozco as we continue to discuss immigration, and we'll hear from Jeffrey what coyote capitalism is all about. That's coming up after a break. You're listening to The Kojo Namdi Show.
On Thursday, the people of the United Kingdom will be voting.
After 13 years of Labour government, have British voters decided it's time for a change? I'm Robin Lustig, and as soon as the polls close, I'll be bringing you the election results as they come in. Who will be Britain's next Prime Minister?
The UK election 2010 from the BBC, making it clear.
That's tomorrow night from 7 to 11 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Corcoran College of Art and Design, offering graduate programs in art education, interior design, photojournalism, history of decorative arts, exhibition design, and art and the book. More at corcoran.edu. From the Washington Business Journal, the local business authority since 1982, providing in-depth coverage on local business news around Greater Washington for more than 28 years. More information at washingtonbusinessjournal.com. From the UPS Store, offering security for mail and packages. With a store mailbox, business mail gets a street address and package acceptance from all carriers. Locations at theupsstore.com.
WAMU 88.5 and Wolf Trap are giving away tickets to the Mikado Saturday, May 22nd at 8 p.m. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar. 79 degrees in Northwest Washington as we resume the discussion on the Kojo Namdi Show.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo, and we're talking about immigration with Manuel Orozco and Jeffrey Kay. You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850. And Jeffrey Kay, your book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. The word coyote, we think probably foremost about the shady guys who ferry illegal immigrants across the Mexican border. But in your book, you use the term coyote capitalism to mean something somewhat different.
Well, or similar, actually, I think. And it's not just guys, it's women, too, who ferry people across the Mexican border. I interviewed a woman smuggler who headed a network in Mexico. Coyote capitalism is a term that I use to describe sort of a global system. System is probably too strong a term, but the job of a coyote, a smuggler, is to get someone across a border. They don't really care about what's pushing them out or what's pulling them in. They get paid just by delivering somebody, getting them from point A to point B. So the circumstances of their departure, their arrival, what happens to them once they get to where they're going is not really a concern. And that's, so I'm using the term as an all-encompassing one to talk about sort of a disregard for the welfare of the migrant, but a system that nonetheless encourages migration.
And Manuel Orozco, when people come here, obviously money is one of the major factors that they're looking for, and they send a lot of that money back home, the remittances that we talked about earlier. Where is that money going when immigrants send it home? Do the people back home put it in the bank or stuff it under their mattresses? We have a phenomenon here in Washington where we have quite a number of immigrants who arrive here and then work here for just a few months a year and earn enough to send back home. And actually go back home for 6 months, or even longer, out of each year, and actually live quite well back home on what they were able to make in service jobs here.
The money ends in the same way your money and my money ends up, paying rent, buying food, and leaving a little bit of money for savings. The impact that this sending of money has had is that it has increased income of people who receive remittances, which, for example, we're talking about millions of people, 10% of many countries in Latin America, at least. It raises their income at least by 200%. If you were earning $100 and now you're getting $300, well, that's the effect that it has on you. It improves your spending capacity, the quality of life, but also it leaves some money for saving. The effect of this is that remittance recipient households today are more likely to save, and they're holding a stock of savings that equals to about $1,500, which is quite significantly high than compared to any other sector except the top 5% of their country's economies. Now, that money, unfortunately, is, for the most part, informally kept under the mattress, as you typically call it. And the reason is because there is still not a substantive effort to bring people into the financial system and leverage those savings. The issue is not about remittances, but it's about the stock of savings that you accumulate as a result of the increased disposable income that comes out of remittances. And that's basically where the money ends.
Mm-hmm. Oso in Burke, it's your turn. Oso?
Hi, Hal. Hello, I wanted to speak to that. I was curious, why don't we open up either privately owned and federally controlled fast-track processing centers on both sides of the borders? That way, when the person comes up, they go in, take the picture, get their fingerprints, get an idea who they are, and charge them $500, send them across the border, and do it again. Get your security, set up cottage industries, capitalize on it. Take the money away from the coyotes.
Jeffrey?
Well, I think that assumes that we want an infinite supply of migrant labor, and I'm not so sure that would go down too well. But, you know, the other issue, I think, that needs to also be considered is what happens to the migrants themselves, and why are migrants coming, and should we be selfishly looking at this just in terms of how it affects us? And I think we often lose sight of the humanity here. One of the most poignant things I came across in my research as I went around the world is meeting with some Filipino migrants in an activist organization who had as their slogan, "We dream of a society that will not be torn apart just for the need to survive." And that sort of really hit home, because here in the United States, and it's not just the United States, it's every developed country that's dealing with this. You know, Britain is going to be having its elections tomorrow. One of the big issues there is immigration. But every developed country seems to just think about what do they mean for us, what can they bring for us, and how can we control migrants without really thinking about the welfare of the migrants themselves and what can be done to support them. And
you've traveled to places such as the United Arab Emirates, where more than 90% of the labor force consists of foreign-born workers, and obviously they are not as welcomed and assimilated into the society as immigrants tend to be over time in this country.
It depends what section of the economy you're looking at, but generally, no. I mean, the rulers pretty much keep to themselves. And the migrants, whether they're in managerial positions or construction workers, keep to themselves, often in labor camps.
And does that have a destabilizing effect long term on the countries where there are so many foreign workers and they are not in any way brought into the society?
I don't know if it destabilizes them, but it's a fairly bizarre sight to see. I think it's sort of immigration and the exploitation and use of foreign labor taken to the extreme. Well, you can argue whether it destabilizes society, but the people there are certainly have no stakes in the society. Their labor's being rented, and when they're finished, they'll be shipped home.
Manuel, we've been talking a lot about the economic forces at play driving people to leave their own homes, and yet there are many people in this country who perceive immigration in a very different way. Nora emails to say, "I can't believe no one is mentioning the issue of drug trafficking in this discussion. There's a veritable pipeline through Arizona pushed by dangerous people armed with everything from pistols to AK-47s. They represent a danger to innocent American landowners who get in their way." And she points out that Phoenix now has a high rate of kidnapping. She says, "Please be fair enough to bring all this into your discussion." Manuel?
Well, I think I will ask how to do that, because migration occurs under particular circumstances and reasons, some of which Jeff is talking about, you know, the economics of capitalism for a demand of foreign labor for which there is not significant or appropriate care for them. There are other factors that explain why people are migrating. Some of them have to do with, yes, the developing conditions in their home countries. Others have to do with politics, foreign policy, trade, colonialism. I mean, if you look at, if you trace back the lines of migration that take place between one country and the other, they are directly connected to colonial rule. Take France, for example. Where are the main immigrants in France coming from? Or Russia, for example, you know, the former Soviet Union countries are now CIS countries who have basically a visa to come in. So there are many factors that explain the migration process. Now, where does organized fit into this equation? If you think of migration as a, as connected to structural as well as instrumental dynamics, one of the instrumental dynamics of migration is the intermediation of how people are crossing borders. And increasingly, in some parts, as a result of the lack of regulation and immigration reform, you have had the role of organized crime taking over the role of being the coyote, the old-fashioned coyote, the individual entrepreneur who will go across the Rio Grande. Now you have a network that relies sometimes, but not always, there is no connection per se, of the same places where drugs are crossed, also the places where immigrants are being crossed. But I think it's quite dangerous to draw the causality or the relationship between the two, because then you're arriving more into opinions rather than facts, and I don't think that, you know, we want to get there.
Jeff?
Well, beyond that, I think, we do really need, in making these broad charges, to think about history and the role of organized crime. And organized crime has always been with us as people have immigrated. Every ethnic group has had its unsavory characters. But in the case of Mexico and the drug trades and the cartels battling each other out, I think it's also extremely important not to conflate the drug trafficking, the battles between the cartels, and immigration. Obviously, you know, we can talk about the routes that some of these folks take, but they're separate issues. And obviously, the big battles that are going on among the drug cartels in Mexico are driven by the demand for drugs in the United States. And again, that, you know, that's probably a subject for another program.
Alex in Washington, it's your turn.
Is this for Alex?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to make a point as an immigrant. I am a naturalized immigrant, came here at the age of 6, speaking only Spanish. And I had to learn English watching Arthur Godfrey on television. And most of my family is had been born elsewhere, and that's about 15 people, and we're all pretty much to a man and woman opposed to granting amnesty to illegal immigrants. And we figure we waited years to get our visas, and there's no reason why people elsewhere can't do the same thing as people are doing right now. I don't think that being able to evade the Border Patrol qualifies one for hero status or special treatment. I think people who come across that border know what they're doing. They're not victims. They're volunteers for this situation which they put themselves in. And when their families are broken apart, they knew that that was a possibility. One of the things that I don't hear being mentioned is when it comes to considering the welfare of these illegal immigrants, is the role of the nation of Mexico as a player here, because Mexico, we know, is a grossly corrupt kleptocracy, which is run by a small oligarchy, which keeps all the profits from its wealth, and it has a lot of wealth, to itself, and spends none on the infrastructure of the country.
Okay.
Why don't we hold Mexico to account? I would like to see regime change brought about in Mexico.
Manuel?
Why do you let us? Look, let me start with the following. You're making a very fair point, and I don't think Europeans should be ignored. I think it's actually part of that 50% or 51% of the population that thinks that way. And there is another percent, and I include myself in the other side, that because of the conditions by which people took place, not just because they crossed the border and evaded the migra is because they should be given immigration status, legal status. There are other reasons, much more complex than that, that make this issue more difficult to decipher. So I agree with you, but I think it's an incomplete argument. On the other hand, do you have the other point about holding Mexico accountable? I couldn't disagree with you either, because at the end of the day, the necessity of people to migrate is not made simply because it's cool to cross the border and risk your life and separate from your family. It's nothing but that, but it's a reality that results in part because of the progress of inequality and poverty. I don't think that you can just generalize and accuse Mexico at the same time of being corrupt, but I think there is a problem that you have to hold accountable these governments by. And I think any immigration reform should have some element of cross-conditionality on any type of immigration reform that has to take place. But, yes.
Okay. We only have a few seconds left. Jeffrey, I wonder if we could wrap this up with a short immigration story of your own, your journey to this country in 30 seconds.
Well, I came as a teenager with my parents from England. And we migrated for the same reason most people do. My father was a jeweler, a manufacturing jeweler, an artisan. He made stuff with his hands. Economy was bad in England. Taxes went up. He couldn't make a living. So like many migrants, we came to the United States so that my parents could make a better living and send their kids through college. Just as my own grandparents and great-grandparents left Eastern Europe. For much of the same reasons, driven by a combination of anti-Semitism and by economic conditions in Eastern Europe. We're all on the march for one reason or another.
And the reasons stay fairly stable, except for the situations in each country.
Obviously, yes.
Jeffrey Kay is a journalist and longtime contributor to the PBS NewsHour. He's the author of Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. And he'll be speaking and signing copies of his book tonight at 7 p.m., at Borders Bookstore at 18th and K Street Northwest in downtown D.C. Manuel Orozco is Director of Remittances and Development at the Inter-American Dialogue. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Diane Vogel, Brendan Sweeney, Tara Boyle, Michael Martinez, and Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. Thanks for listening. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, it's the district's prescription for childhood obesity, a law requiring healthier lunches and more exercise at school. Then, Hollywood on the Potomac, the challenge of making a movie in 48 hours. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the UPS Store, offering security for mail and packages. With a store mailbox, business mail gets...